On the other hand, she waited. She wanted to tell them at just the right time, in just the right way, using just the right words. Yet, as fans of the Scottish poet Mr. Robert Burns will know, the best laid schemes o' mice and men gang oft agley. To gang oft agley means to often go astray, much like Mrs. Penworthy's wig, which was easily knocked askew. These curious words are from the poem called To a Mouse, but the sentiment does not apply solely to rodents or to wigs, for that matter. What they mean is this. Whether one is a man, a mouse, a governess, or an incorrigible, the great plot twists of life will arrange themselves as they see fit, regardless of how much fretting and planning one does in advance. This is not cause for alarm. Quite the opposite. It is a comforting reminder that worrying serves little purpose. Worse, it takes up valuable time that could be better spent reading novels, taking walks in a shaded park, having friends over for tea and biscuits, and any number of equally pleasant pursuits. Out to the garden the five young people ran. The balloon had crashed right in the middle of the daffodils. The wicker basket was large and shaped like a gondola, just as Admiral Forsay had described. The balloon itself had been cleverly camouflaged as a full moon. Now it was almost completely deflated and lay in a heap on the ground. Beneath it were three figures struggling to get out from beneath the fabric. The incorrigibles had personal experience being covered by bedsheets while pretending to be ghosties, so it was all one big man-in-the-moon costume to them. They knew just what to do, and they ran full tilt to help this troika of newcomers wriggle free.
"One, two, three!" the children yelled, and lifted the crumpled balloon up, up, and away.
None of the three were strangers to Penelope, of course, although she was surprised to see Miss Charlotte Mortimer among them. The children also knew and loved Miss Mortimer, for they had met her at the Swanburn Academy. She embraced them fiercely.
"My dear children, just who I wanted to see."
Pater Lumley stepped forward from the wrecked balloon. Mater Lumley did too, and took her husband's hand. They had the strangest expressions on their faces.
"Alexander, Beowulf, Cassiopeia, we are your parents," Pater Lumley said. "I am sorry we have been away so long."
Luckily, the incorrigibles were prepared. As they had been taught to do by their governess, they used their very best socially useful phrases. Truly, their manners were beyond reproach.
"How do you do?"
Cassiopeia said grandly, with a curtsy that touched the ground.
"Greetings, noble parents. It is a pleasure to make your acquaintance."
Beowulf tipped an imaginary hat and bowed with flair.
"We welcome you to Ashton Place, respected ancestors," Alexander proclaimed, then clicked his heels together three times in the Russian style.
Beowulf did the same, and Cassiopeia performed a ballerina twirl on tiptoes. The children seemed quite pleased with themselves.
"Well, I'm glad that's all settled," Mater Lumley said, and laughed.
Penelope laughed too, for it was just what she had said to the children upon first meeting them.
"Allow me to introduce Simon Harley Dickinson," she said, pushing him forward.
"And Mrs. Penworthy,"
Alexander added for complete accuracy. Simon took Pater Lumley's hand and bowed to both ladies.
"It's a true pleasure. Forgive my costume. There's a long story attached."
Miss Mortimer placed a hand on his arm. "And we are eager to hear it, Simon, but it will have to wait until later. We have a more urgent problem. It seems our balloon had a stowaway."
"Edward Ashton," Penelope blurted.
It was not a question. She knew her adversary too well. Simon wheeled around, searching.
"Blast! I was hoping we'd seen the last of that scoundrel."
Miss Mortimer looked grim. "Yes, it is because of Edward Ashton we landed so abruptly. He's gone quite mad, I fear. There is a great deal to tell you, but not here, not in the open." Penelope glanced over her right shoulder, then her left. but saw nothing but trees, brave yellow daffodils, and the fallen moon balloon. Still, she trusted Miss Mortimer's judgment.
"We had best go to the house, then," she said, leading the way. "Mrs. Clark will find us a safe place to talk, and a hot meal, too. I expect she'll be happily surprised to see me, and overjoyed to meet you." Peter Lumley turned to the incorrigibles.
"Come along, children. Follow your sister."
Confused, the boys looked at Cassiopeia, who was behind them. The little girl shrugged. Then all three heads swiveled to Penelope.
"Sister Woo!"
They howled, full-throated. No need for bows and curtsies, handshakes and socially useful phrases now. They pounced on her like a trio of cubs, yapping and laughing till they were breathless with joy. It was all they could do not to lick her face, although, to be frank, she would not have minded one bit. Which only goes to prove, although no further proof is needed, that sometimes just the right words are no words at all. No disrespect to Shakespeare, Tolstoy, or Moby Dick is intended by this, for every poet knows it already. As the proverb tells us, speech is silver, silence is golden. And nothing more need be said about that. On the way to the house, they passed old Timothy, heading toward the garden. His pace was remarkably slow. He stopped often to sniff the flowers, and there were plenty to sniff, since it was the first week of May, and nearly everything was in bloom. He ambled, he strolled, he sauntered, and seemed in no rush to get to his destination.
"Good day, good day," he remarked. "What a fine day for a group of strangers with no prior knowledge of each other to meet by chance on the garden path, as it were."
The incorrigibles thought he was joking.
"But you know who we are," they cried.
"Do I, though?" He gave them a stern, cock-eyed look. "Most people don't know the first thing about who they are. Never mind the rest of humanity. How am I, a poor old coachman, supposed to keep track of all those names and faces? All I know is that Lord Frederick called for me all urgent-like and told me the full moon had dropped from the sky and landed in the flower beds. He saw it, and Lady Constance saw it too, or so he claims. I know it can't be true, and therefore it isn't true, but I promised I'd have a look, nevertheless."
"But why can't it be true?" Beowulf said, giggling.
It was fun to provoke the enigmatic old fellow.
"Because," he roared.
The children jumped back.
"Because the full moon is until tomorrow. That's a simple fact of time and space, and no amount of yapping can change it. Now, step aside, all you perfect strangers, and I'll be on my way as if we've never met."
"But we have met," the children crowed.
The coachman lowered his voice.
"If I tell Lord Frederick that a moon balloon full of visitors fell from the sky, it'll raise questions, wouldn't it? And questions tend to want answers, don't they? And the poor man has enough on his mind as it is, with tomorrow being the first full moon of May, a fact you people ought to bear in mind, if you exist, which I'm prepared to say you don't. Now, good day, and we'll not speak of this again."
"Quite right. Good day to you too, sir," Mrs. Mortimer said, deeply amused.
"Wait, almost forgot."
He reached inside his coat.
"Funny, the random rubbish birds steal from their nests and then drop along the way. Here, sailor boy, you take it. It'll prop open a window in a pinch."
He handed Penelope the object in question and went on his way, calling over his shoulder,
"Can't have flotsam and jetsam in the flower beds. No siree."
Penelope was speechless. It was her book of melancholy German poems in translation. The children recognized it at once.
"We lent it to Master Gogolev when he was writing poems," Alexander explained. "Then he was gone, and the book was too."
Beowulf sniffed the binding.
"It used to smell like Lummerwoo. Now it smells like an unhappy person with no friends."
"Master Gogolev must have given it to Edward Ashton," Peter Lumley said to his wife, who had gasped in surprise at the discovery.
Now she looked rueful.
"He should have asked first,"
Cassiopeia said crossly.
"Yes, he should have," Penelope agreed. She was amazed to have the familiar and much-loved book back in her hands. "But it no longer matters, for the book has found its way home, as we all have." A torn strip of black fabric from Edward Ashton's cloak, perhaps, was tucked inside as a bookmark. She opened to the marked page and read aloud.
I wander through the meadows green, made happy by the verdant scene.
That book is how Edward Ashton found us in Frankenford. The clue is on the first page, Mater Lumley added, in answer to Penelope's questioning look. Penelope flipped to the beginning.
Published by Degrees, she read. At 54 North and 12 East, Globerstrasse.
Globerstrasse means Globe Street,
Alexander translated, for he still remembered some German from his earliest years.
And published by Degrees,
Simon stroked his chin.
Hang on, 54 degrees north and 12 degrees east, those are numbers of latitude and longitude. If I had my maps handy, you would discover that they point to Frankenford.
Pater Lumley patted the young navigator on the back of his floral patterned dress.
Good thinking, Simon. It's the rare baby nurse who could figure that out so quickly.
Miss Mortimer frowned.
Susanna, if I had known about this, you would never have given her the book.
I know. It was a risk I ought not have taken. Mater Lumley turned to Penelope.
I left the clue for you, Penny. I had hoped one day you would figure it out and find comfort in knowing where we were, at least.
Geography was never my best subject, Penelope sheepishly admitted. All those mid-sized European nations and their capital cities, imports and exports, what have you, I could hardly keep them straight.
Simon adjusted his wig, which had gang aglay once more.
I'd have spotted it straight away if I'd seen it. Serves me right for not reading more poetry.
Miss Mortimer hustled them along.
There will be plenty of time for poetry, if all goes well. Now, let us get inside and put ourselves in Mrs. Clark's care. Gossip travels quickly in a house such as this. It is best for us to remain incognito for a little while longer, at least.
The expression on Mrs. Clark's face was a sight to behold.
Miss Lumley, my word, you've come home at last. Well, nothing should surprise me ever again, and that's the truth. Here's Simon trotting about in my old clothes, and you drop in from the sky, the very sky itself, dressed like a sailor boy, and the servants are gossiping about a moon falling in the daffodils, and look who turns up.
She paused to dab her eyes. She was already on her third pocket handkerchief.
It's your long-lost Ma and Pa! And now you tell me these three precious children are Lumley's too. I don't know what to say, except Providence is kind and we oughtn't ever lose hope, for there's no telling what the next hour will bring, is there?
They had gathered in a cozy downstairs room off the kitchen that only the servants used. Most great houses of the day would not bother with such a room, but at Ashton Place, Mrs. Clark was in charge, and she wanted her staff to have a comfortable spot to take tea breaks and put their feet up when they were tired. She had decorated the room herself. It was a riot of floral patterns, soft carpets, and comfortable furniture strewn with pillows, nothing like the formal, antique-filled rooms upstairs. Trays of hot tea and buttered toast were brought out, and pitchers of milk and biscuits for the children. Once they were settled, Mater Lumley, Pater Lumley, and Miss Mortimer promised to tell the tale of how they had ended up crushing their balloon in the garden. You may think of it as the tale of the moon balloon landing, although nowadays moon landing has come to mean something quite different, as the astronauts among you are well aware. Mater Lumley helped herself to more tea and a biscuit too. Then she began.
Penelope, even before you surprised us by showing up in Frankenford, we had arranged for your Aunt Charlotte, yes, children, Miss Mortimer is your aunt as well, to fly our balloon from its hiding place in a remote part of the Alps to the meadow green outside the town. I had done it before several times, Miss Mortimer said, and always on the night of the new moon, to avoid having too many moons in the sky at once. This time, we could not wait. Years from now, I expect, grandparents will tell their grandchildren stories of that strange day when there were two moons in the sky.
Moon plus moon equals two moons,
Cassiopeia said, clearly thrilled at the notion.
Indeed it does, Cassio Wolf.
I was delayed, rather embarrassingly, when I made a right turn at the Danube River instead of a left. Such a beautiful sight. I grew distracted while admiring it and got quite turned around.
Now Pater Lumley picked up the tale.
Charlotte arrives not long after Penelope and Admiral Forsay took off in his balloon. Quickly, we prepared to leave. We had released all the ropes but one when Edward Ashton himself came crashing out of the trees and into the meadow.
But how did he find you? Penelope asked. That meadow was so tucked away and private.
He did have the exact latitude and longitude, though, Simon answered. Yes, and he may have seen the first balloon rise from the forest. Or perhaps he was just lucky, Pater Lumley went on. He was wild and incoherent, and soaking wet, too. He must have swum across the lake. Even as our balloon rose from the ground, he seized that last anchor rope and tried to stop us. But we got away, or so we thought.
Unbeknownst to us, Ashton had climbed up the rope and lashed himself to the bottom of the gondola. Imagine riding in the open air like that, all the way to England. But we did not fly nearly as high as you and Admiral Forsay did. Our balloon is, or should I say, was well camouflaged, Matter Lumley said. Your father painted an excellent moon face, didn't he, children?
Moon balloon,
the children agreed. They tossed biscuits into the air and caught them in their mouths. It was a joyous reunion, after all. Miss Mortimer tossed and caught one, too. I thought our ship of the air was not flying quite right, she said after she was done swallowing. I blamed it on the extra sandwiches we packed. Still, we made it to England swiftly, thanks to favourable winds. She leaned forward, as a good storyteller does when the most exciting part is about to be told. It was not until we were quite close, but still high above the forest that surrounds Ashton Place, that Edward Ashton made himself known. He hauled himself up the ropes. Before we could subdue him, he smashed a pair of thick spectacles he must have had with him and used the broken glass to poke our balloon full of holes. Like Swiss cheese. Cassiopeia turned to her brothers.
See, the moon is made of cheese.
All three patted their tummies. That would be a great deal of cheese, for sure. We lurched and nearly tipped, Miss Mortimer went on. Ashton dangled from the ropes above.
Thanks for the lift,
he said, and jumped. He jumped from the balloon in midair. But surely he was killed, Penelope exclaimed. The three balloonists shook her heads. He had made himself a parachute out of his own dark cloak, Miss Mortimer explained. I think we must assume he survived. He must have dropped the book of poems during his fall, Penelope looked thoughtful. Come to think of it, there has been no news of Admiral Forsay since I too jumped ship. I hope he is all right. In answer to Simon's surprised look, she said, I held a low opinion of the Admiral before our trip, but there is something about sharing an adventure that makes friends of the most unlikely companions. Miss Mortimer nodded in agreement. I expect the Admiral landed safely. His vessel was in good condition, the weather was fair, and he is an experienced pilot. But balloons are unpredictable and easily blown off course. He could be in a different part of England altogether.
I'd bet the moon itself he's all right. That Forsay fellow has a knack for survival and self-invention, too.
Simon turned to the rest of them.
Speaking of survival and moons, our soothsayer friend, Madame Ionesco, warned us to expect real theatrics from beyond the veil tomorrow. The first full moon of May means closing night for the curse upon the Ashtons, as we theatre folk say. I wish there was something we could do to prepare.
Miss Mortimer paused to take a deep, calming breath, which made Penelope even more worried than before.
Does the fortune-teller have a plan?
The headmistress asked.
After a fashion, Penelope replied. It involves some complex negotiations, with parties no longer living.
We don't want anyone to commit murder, Beowulf explained.
The incorrigible children were now curled in their blankets, still listening.
I am glad to hear it, Beowulf,
Miss Mortimer tucked her legs beneath her on the sofa. Everyone was getting sleepy, it seemed.
"We must be vigilant about Edward Ashton, for he is unhinged and capable of anything. As for the spirits beyond the veil, I fear there is nothing we can do to prepare for them. We will put our trust in your friend, the soothsayer."
"When it comes to the supernatural, Madame Ionesco is as reliable as they come. I realize that's not saying much, but I think the old girl can pull it off,"
Simon declared. Still, an air of doubt had entered the room.
"We must hope for the best," Peter Lumley said firmly. "The main thing is that we are together now. We are safe for the moment, and there is nothing to do but wait."
"No matter what happens tomorrow, we have these hours together at least." Her words sounded grim, but Maida Lumley was smiling. "And you must have so many questions for us. All those questions you have saved for later. Now you may ask away. We truly have all the time in the world." There was so much to ask and to tell. Penelope and the Incorrigibles heard about their parents' years in remote alpine villages on the run from danger with baby Penelope in tow. "The hunt was on for us, but it was our children Edward Ashton wanted, even before you were born," Maida Lumley explained. "We used fake names and disguises and stayed on the move. We succeeded in keeping you a secret, Penny dear. He never knew you existed. But it was only a matter of time. You were getting older. You needed safety and stability, an education, and other children to play with. We had to face facts." Thus the Lumleys had made the heartbreaking decision to hide Penelope in plain sight, as it were, at the Swanburn Academy. They dared not visit, but kept a close eye on their daughter through Charlotte. "We hoped Ashton would give up. But he had his spies watching us always. Some awful baroness, an earl of some kind or other," Maida Lumley said.
"Baroness Hoover and the Earl of Maytag," Penelope shivered at the names.
"Yes, many times we slipped away at the 11th hour. We missed you dreadfully, Penny, but there seemed no way to contact you without putting you in danger.
And thanks to the hair poultice, you appeared to be one Swanburn girl among many,"
Miss Mortimer interjected.
"You were a needle in a haystack, to be sure," Simon teased.
Penelope shook her head.
"That poultice, how she had disliked it. But now she knew the reason for it, at least."
Peter Lumley went on.
"We grew even more skilled at travelling incognito and hiding our whereabouts. To our great delight, we were blessed with 3 more children. We discovered ballooning, which changed everything, or so we thought. We allowed ourselves to feel safe, so safe that we began to think we might soon bring you home again, Penelope. But then came that day, that dreadful day, when the 3 littlest Lumleys disappeared."
It was quite an experience for the Incorrigibles to hear this spellbinding story, especially since it was about them. However, their bellies were full of milk and biscuits, and they had made a marvellous pillow fort on the floor to snuggle in. So they listened the way they might have listened to any bedtime story, wriggling and poking one another, and looking as if they were not listening at all. Maida Lumley dabbed her eyes with a pocket handkerchief.
"We have made a brief landing in a field near the village of Heidiheim to replenish our water jugs from the stream there and to purchase some goat's milk and cheese from a farmer we knew well. Our backs were turned for only a moment, and the children were gone."
"Maybe we went to pick flowers," Cassiopeia suggested. "Or for yodeling lessons,"
Beowulf gave it a try.
"Yodel-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o-o
Alexander said. Those were terrible days, Mater Lumley shook her head. But we had loyal spies of our own. Charlotte, of course, and old Timothy.
Enigmatic old Tim? He had me fooled for ages, Simon said. He'd make a swell actor.
I always liked him,
Beowulf said with sleepy conviction, which made everyone laugh.
With their help, we learned that the children had been spirited away to England and left in the forest of Ashton Place. Imagine! Our own dear children lost in the woods. It was like something out of the Brothers Grimm. Of course, we were frightened, but Timothy found clever ways to care for them, as did some rather unusual wolves. The children yapped softly at the mention of the wolves. Peter Lumley patted Alexander's head, which was nearest to him.
The wolves were a reminder that the stranger curse upon the Ashtons was a mystery bigger than mere reason could overrule. Like one of those tragic plays from ancient Greece, Simon offered. Every time you try to flee your fate, it only makes things worse.
Mater Lumley nodded. Yes, we worried that any attempt at rescue could backfire, and we dared not provoke Edward Ashton to action, for we feared what his action would be.
Murder,
cried Beowulf.
Most foul,
Cassiopeia said with feeling.
As in the best it is,
Alexander concluded. It was one of the ghost's lines from Hamlet, and the children said it with such spirit that everyone felt moved to applaud. The children bowed and snuggled back into their pillow fort.
We had no choice but to trust in Providence, Mater Lumley continued gently, addressing the children. Penelope was happy at Swanburn, and under her Aunt Charlotte's care, and you three were having a wonderful time with the wolves. What better protectors could you have? We believed you were safe, as long as Frederick did not find you. For years, he did not.
But then he did find them, Penelope said quietly.
Yes, thank goodness old Timothy made sure no one was harmed.
That Lord Frederick brought the children home to live as his wards was something no one expected, Peter Lumley said. We still don't fully understand why Frederick took them in, though of course we are glad he did.
I can explain that, Penelope straightened, for she too was slumped with fatigue. It was long past her bedtime by now.
As a child, Lord Frederick was cruelly teased for barking and howling when the moon was full. The incorrigible's wolfish behaviour reminded him of his own, but they had no shame about it. He hoped to learn that from them. Alexander sat up.
He wants us to woofy up the baby, too, he said.
What? Penelope exclaimed. This was the first anyone else had heard about it, and all heads turned.
He asked us, too.
Beowulf crawled out of the pillow fort and sat on his haunches.
To bark and howl and teach the baby to be wolfish.
Cassiopeia popped out as well.
We have been practicing. Listen.
The incorrigibles proceeded to bark and howl with all their might.
Mater and Peter Lumley were amazed.
What excellent howlers. You'll have to teach us to do it too,
Peter Lumley said, ruffling Beowulf's hair.
Miss Mortimer had been listening hard to all of this. It seems we may have underestimated Frederick, she said to Mater Lumley. She turned to Penelope.
As soon as the children were found by Lord Frederick, the Ashtons placed an advertisement for a governess. You know what happened after that. Meanwhile, your parents had taken to spending most of the year in the air. I visited as often as I could and helped transport the balloon to its various hiding places, mostly high in the Alps.
She gave a sad smile. The good ship Chanteloup served us well.
Chanteloup? Penelope repeated, recognizing the name. Miss Mortimer, did you name your cat after the balloon?
The headmistress smiled. Chanteloup is French. It means song of the wolf. I named my cat after my favorite poet.
And I named our balloon after my favorite poet, Peter Lumley said, a playful twinkle in his eye.
He wrote it down so the children could see how it was spelled. Only then did they recognize the word.
That is our favorite poet, too, Beowulf said.
Penelope had already figured it out. She held up the book so the children could see.
See? It is right on the front.
Chanteloup was my nom de plume, Mater Lumley said modestly. I started using it when I wrote my very first verse. I was only 16 at the time.
Tell us, tell us,
the children cried.
Oh, I think you know it already, Mater Lumley laughed and began to sing. All hail to our founder, Agatha, pithy and wise is she.
Penelope's own mother had written the Swanburn school song. Really, what were the odds?
To think, I have been singing it all these years,
she began, but she became choked up, and all conversation stopped while her parents took turns hugging her.
I have a question, Alexander said shyly when things had settled once more. What are our Lumley names? I think I might remember mine, a little.
Mater and Pater Lumley exchanged a glance.
What do you remember? Pater Lumley asked.
Was it Sam?
Mater Lumley's hands flew to her heart.
Yes, it was. We called you Samuel, after my father and Charlotte's, but you have become Alexander Incorrigible now, haven't you?
He nodded eagerly, for he did want to keep his own name.
Then, of course, that is who you are.
I don't remember my Lumley name, Beowulf confessed. I don't either.
Cassiopeia looked worried, for to learn to spell a second name when she was not yet on solid ground with the first would be asking a great deal. Pater Lumley gathered his two youngest children onto his lap.
Beowulf is your Incorrigible Lumley name, and Cassiopeia is yours.
Mater Lumley put her hand on Alexander's head. With the other, she squeezed Penelope's hand. You are all Incorrigible Lumleys, through and through. Mrs. Clark had been quiet all this time, taking in every word as her knitting needles silently flew. Now she paused in her work. She rummaged in her pockets for another clean pocket handkerchief, wiped her eyes, and blew her nose with gusto. Yet when she spoke, her tone was chatty, as if it were some other kind-hearted housekeeper who had just been overcome with tears for the 12th time that day.
"I wonder what name Lord Frederick and Lady Constance has picked for the baby," she chirped. "They haven't mentioned it. I suppose we'll find out soon enough."
"Too soon for my taste," Simon blurted, but he was not the only one who thought it. Who knew what the next day would hold?
The good housekeeper tried again to say something cheerful, for she was one of those people who believe too much silence makes a room gloomy. She glanced outside and remarked,
"It's always so dark before the moon rises, isn't it?"
No one could argue with that.
The 15th and final chapter.
The night of the full moon comes at last. While the Lumleys slept, the moon rose. It was full and round as a loaf of gypsy cake, and bright enough to cast long, dancing shadows on the grass. Beyond the veil, the spirits stirred. In the bakehouse, the dough for the morning's bread rose. It is safe to say the soothsayer got very little sleep that night, but she was not the only one awake. At the grand house known as Ashton Place, something else began to stir, too. Imagine a tulip bulb that has spent long months asleep in the cool, dark earth. One day, whether through happenstance, the hands on the clock, the phases of the moon, or some secret primordial plan, the moment comes when it is finally ready to sprout. On the outside, very little changes, at least at first. Inside, however, great events begin to unfold. Lady Constance was no stranger to complaining, but this was something altogether different. She had spent the night waking and dozing and waking again. Unable to sit still, she wandered the halls like a restless ghost. Every hour or so, she asked for snacks, but left most uneaten. As the day of the full moon dawned and blossomed, her restlessness turned into something more, well, cow-like.
Moo!
She said, after demanding more tea and, of course, chocolates.
Moo!
When she was done mooing, she looked surprised.
Frederick, is there a cow in here?
She asked.
He had not left her side for hours.
Not that I can tell, dear.
Lack of sleep made him even more bleary-eyed than usual.
But you yourself just made the most heartfelt mooing noise. Are you all right?
Was that me? She dabbed her forehead with a napkin from her tray. She was looking quite pink all of a sudden.
For a moment, it felt as if something was getting ready to burst. What I imagine the tulip bulb must feel like when the tulip begins to grow. The most peculiar type of discomfort. Never mind. It's gone now.
She patted his hand and went back to nibbling her chocolate. But before long, that bursting into bloom feeling came again, and that was when Mrs. Clark took over the proceedings.
"You, my lady, are getting ready to have your baby," she announced.
"Moo! Am I? Is that what this noise is all about?"
Lady Constance patted her belly.
"Well, I shall miss being round as the full moon. It is amusing to waddle like a duck, and I have grown used to it. But the baby will be amusing, too. Moo!"
This one came more sharply, almost as a surprise. A drop of sweat trickled down her forehead.
"Mrs. Clark, look!"
She was a little out of breath.
"It seems I may have begun to perspire. Can you imagine such a thing?"
Lord Frederick had no idea what to make of it. He took the housekeeper aside.
"I say, Mrs. Clark, is she turning into a cow?"
"It's all quite normal, your lordship. It only means the baby will be here soon."
Mrs. Clark's tone was reassuring, but she had a businesslike look about her, for there was much to be done. Dr. Weltschmerz was sent for. He arrived within the hour, but declared the situation well in hand and went out for a stroll and a cigar. Margaret ran in and out, bringing fresh towels and water and tea and buttered toast, clean pocket handkerchiefs and whatever else Mrs. Clark ordered. As for Lord Frederick, in Miss Lumley's day, it was the custom for a father-to-be to wait out these sorts of occasions at his gentleman's club, where he could smoke a pipe, drink a glass of brandy, talk politics, and so on. However, Lord Frederick was much too concerned about Constance and the bouncing baby Ashton to set one foot outside his wife's bedchamber. He hovered like an anxious mother hen and spent as much time mopping his own brow as he did his wife's. Interestingly, the person Lady Constance most wanted by her side was Mrs. Elsinore Penworthy. Margaret was sent to fetch the baby nurse, galumphing downstairs in a flash, wig only slightly askew, or aglie if you prefer the old Scottish word. Lady Constance lit up like the dawn to see her dear lady friend.
"Mrs. Penworthy, may I call you Elsinore? Take my hand, if you please, more!"
By this point, her cheeks turned bright red each time the feeling came.
"My word, this is going to be rather a large tulip, I think."
Simon, that is to say, Mrs. Penworthy, squeezed her hand gamely.
"Just imagine how lovely it will be when it blossoms," she crooned.
Firm in their resolve to enjoy each other's company fully until fate might decree otherwise, Penelope and the children were giving Miss Mortimer and Mater and Pater Lumley a tour of the nursery when the news came. The grown-ups had oohed and aahed over the excellent globe and the well-stocked bookshelves, the watercolour paints and the abacus, the wooden building blocks and all the knitted gifts the incorrigible children had begun, if not always finished. Miss Mortimer was especially charmed by the large, sunny window.
"What a fine-looking elm tree, with such graceful, spreading branches," she remarked. "And those sweet springtime sounds of the warblers and nuthatches are like music to the ear."
"Eek!"
It was Margaret who had arrived at a gallop and now stood squealing with excitement in the doorway.
"There you are! Mrs. Clark told me to run quick as the wind and tell you four things. The baby's on its way. The doctor's come and gone. Mrs. Penworthy's looking after Lady Constance."
"Mrs. Penworthy!" Penelope exclaimed. She would not have taken Simon for a midwife.
"Well, she is the baby nurse, after all. Drat, now I've lost track. How many was that?"
"Three,"
the children cried.
"One more, then. Let me think. Oh, the baker. That was it. She wants you to send for the baker. Right away."
"Yes,
Maida Lumley glanced anxiously at her husband and seized a cardigan from the pile of knitted things as if preparing to go out. "We must fetch the baker now." He nodded and threw a scarf around his neck.
"No having babies without the baker. No sorry."
"Certainly, the baker must be summoned at once," Mrs. Mortimer said with urgency and pulled on some mittens.
"The baker! The baker!"
the children yelled and ran around frantically dressing themselves in knitwear from head to toe. Margaret, who was not privy to all the complexities of the situation, seemed puzzled by this sudden outcry for baking expertise.
"Excuse me,"
she chirped,
"but what's the point of a baker when a lady's having a child?"
"I am surprised you do not know, Margaret." Penelope's words poured out lickety-split, for now that the big moment had arrived, she too was overcome with nerves.
"Having a baby is hard, hungry work, and a snack is bound to come in useful. And no one knows better than a baker how to take loaves and muffins and pies and buns out of the oven. And having a baby is like that, very much like it indeed. Now, run to the bakehouse, children, quick. Tell Madame, that is, Flora, the bread lady, to come to the house right away."
And that is how the phrase, "having a bun in the oven," came to mean soon to have a baby. It was Miss Penelope Lumley who first came up with the metaphor, you see, though she is rarely given credit for it. Maida and Peter Lumley accompanied the children to the bakehouse for safety's sake. So far, there had been no sign of Edward Ashton, though old Timothy had been riding the ground since dawn looking for him. The Lumleys soon returned, with Madame Ionesco and as many baskets of fresh bread as they could carry. They marched straight upstairs to Lady Constance's private parlour. Penelope and Miss Mortimer were already there. Lady Constance was in her bedchamber, along with Lord Frederick, Mrs. Clark, and Mrs. Penworthy. Margaret ran in and out as required, but otherwise the door that led from the parlour to the bedchamber stayed closed.
"Make sandwiches. This is going to take a while,"
the soothsayer said to Peter Lumley, putting him in charge of the bread. But there was one special loaf she set aside for Lady Constance.
"I put a little spell on that one," she confided to Penelope. "The new mummy spell. It'll make things easier for her. All right, I'm going in. Nobody leave,"
she admonished them all.
"These things take time. I need all hands on deck. You kids know what that means?"
"Aye, aye, Madam Gypsy Cake,"
the children answered, saluting. Madame Ionesco gave them a wink and disappeared behind the bedchamber door.
"Moo!"
The cow-like lowing sounds came at intervals, and an impromptu waiting room sprang up in the parlour. Extra chairs and small tables were brought in, fresh tea trays were delivered on the half hour, and the empty cups whisked away. Peter Lumley made sandwiches by the dozen, and everyone agreed they were excellent. Maida Lumley taught the children card games. Penelope showed them how to play Duroc, the game she used to play with the Princess Popkinova. Muffled voices and strains of the occasional sea chanty could be heard from the bedchamber, and those who attempted to eavesdrop, which was frankly everyone, bravely fought the urge. As morning turns to afternoon, Mrs. Penworthy, that is to say Simon, popped out of the inner room for a breather. He looked flushed and so nervous, one might also imagine he was having a baby himself.
"I've seen many an opening night, but this is a new twist for me," he said to Penelope, as he gave his scalp a good scratch under the horsehair wig.
She offered him a sandwich of thin sliced cucumber and cream cheese.
"When I assisted at the births of calves and lambs back at the Swanburn Academy, Dr. Westminster always said we should keep calm and trust nature to take its course."
Simon looked unconvinced.
"That's all very well on the farm. It's different when the cow wants you to hold her hand, sing songs, and tell stories the whole blessed time. I'm running out of material."
The bedchamber door opened, and Lord Frederick stepped out.
"Penworthy, there you are. Constance is calling for you."
"Righto, sir. Once more unto the breach."
Simon gave Penelope a helpless look, adjusted his dress, and strode back in.
"I like that, Mrs. Penworthy,"
Lord Frederick remarked to Miss Mortimer as he helped himself to a ham on rye.
A nice, sturdy woman, what? Constance thinks the world of her. I don't suppose you know this, but there have been some strange twists and turns in the Ashton family tree. Makes me a bit anxious about the baby. I suppose that's normal, but when your family's got a curse on it... It's a long story. I'll tell you later, if you're interested. Well, it just makes it all the more stressful.
Miss Mortimer knew all about it, of course.
Frederick, if I may call you that, don't be afraid. We are here to help make sure things go well.
Yes, Peter Lumley came and stood by her.
It's true. We have only just met, sir, but you can count us as your friends.
Maitre Lumley went so far as to lay a hand on Lord Frederick's arm. Your wife and child will be just fine. I am sure of it.
All right, good to hear. No harm in being optimistic, I suppose.
He looked around and took in these visitors as best he could. The calm couple in European clothes, the elegant English headmistress, the slender chap in the sailor suit who looked like he could be Miss Lumley's twin brother. The resemblance was so strong.
Blast! I'm not quite sure how all of you ended up here in my house, but I dare say it feels perfectly at home having you about. The more the merrier, I suppose. That's my girl. I'd best get back inside.
He grabbed another sandwich, a sliced apple, cheddar and mustard.
Very good, very good. Yes, I oughtn't worry. Things are going well.
Lord Frederick was quite correct. Inside the birthing room, nature was taking its course. Outside, the Lumleys stood watch over their cousins, the Ashtons. The task of removing the family curse remained in the spooky hands of Madame Ionesco. But first things first. If Edward Ashton had planned a final act of treachery, the time to attempt it was now. So far, however, he was nowhere to be seen. Hours passed before Madame Ionesco next emerged.
"Cutie,"
she said to Penelope, who had by now dealt so many games of cards her fingers ached.
"Tell the cook I need soup, but not just any soup. The Russian kind, it's red, made of beets, very tasty."
"You mean borscht," Penelope said. "Is it good for a lady in labor?"
Madame grinned her semi-toothless grin.
"Who says it's for her?"
Back into the birthing room she went. The borscht was prepared and delivered, and afternoon turned to evening. It might have been coincidence, but as the sun set and gave the soon-to-rise moon full rein over the sky, Lady Constance's mooing turned to a different kind of sound altogether.
"Ow!"
she howled, quite musically.
"Ow! Ow!"
"That's it, my dear,"
Lord Frederick could be heard cheering her on.
"Awoo! Ow!"
Helpfully, the incorrigible Lumleys joined in too.
"Awoo! Awoo! Awoo!"
But even all that noise was not enough to conceal the thunder of hooves at a gallop, coming ever closer to the house. Penelope leaped to her feet in alarm.
"No!"
This howl of protest came from the window. There, tottering on the edge of the railing that circled the parlour's private balcony, was Edward Ashton.
"Time is running out. 5 cubs to be avenged," he yelled, pounding on the glass.
The French doors opened, and he toppled into the parlour.
"Come here, you rascal!"
It was old Timothy. He scrambled up the vine-covered trellis that led to the balcony, quite nimbly for an old bow-legged coachman.
"You won't get away from me again!" Peter Lumley jumped to assist as old Timothy seized his prey by the collar. "The old schemer was hiding in the woods. I flushed him out of the bushes like a hound flushes out a fox. A merry hunt it was, wouldn't you say, Eddie, old boy?"
The intruder was weak from his ordeals and winded from the climb, and it took little effort to subdue him. Peter Lumley cut down the long, tasseled cord of embroidered gold silk that served as a bell pull and lashed Edward Ashton to a chair.
Apologies for the intrusion, ladies and gents. If not for Dr. Weltschmerz blocking my way, I'd have had this scoundrel bagged before he got past the tulips. But don't worry, I'll deal with the gloomy doctor later.
To Penelope, he added,
I found your friend Forsay, too, while I was searching the woods. He's bruised from a rough landing, but in good working order otherwise.
The door to the bedchamber opened. Lord Frederick stood framed within it. His face was damp with perspiration, but he showed no sign of barking or howling or scratching. The full moon's attention was elsewhere, it seemed.
Blast! My wife's in the middle of having a baby. Can you keep the racket down out here?
Then he saw what was going on, or thought he did.
Quincy, is that you?
Fools, don't you understand we are all doomed? Edward Ashton moaned.
Doomed? What nonsense. Get hold of yourself, sir.
Lord Frederick ordered.
There are children present, for heaven's sake.
Children, yes. But how many?
Edward Ashton fixed the incorrigibles with a piercing stare.
One, two, three. One, two, three.
He lifted his head and glared at Penelope.
Four. But where is the fifth?
Is that why you chased us all over Switzerland, searching for another little Lumley to put in your murderous sights?
Remarkably, Peter Lumley laughed.
That was a lot of trudging through the Alps for nothing, then.
I don't believe you,
Ashton roared, straining against the knots.
I am sorry to disappoint you, Edward, Mater Lumley said in a voice both calm and steely. But these four remarkable children are all we have.
Edward Ashton tried to stand, but the cord was too snug.
But no, it makes no sense.
His eyes darted from one auburn head to the next.
Five cubs to be avenged, the old sailor said. All must be destroyed, or the Ashtons will come to a gruesome and permanent end.
Edward, you really ought to read The Three Musketeers, Miss Mortimer suggested. It has four musketeers in it, but nobody seems to mind.
And stop all that gruesome end talk, or I'll stick a real bag over your head.
Old Timothy was still breathless himself and mopped his brow with a handkerchief.
Now listen up, everyone. There's something I ought to warn you about. Those wolves that live in the forest.
Mater Lumley interrupted. No need to warn us about the wolves, Timothy. For what we've been told, they are friendly as can be. The old coachman tugged at his collar.
Normally, that's true. Wait,
Lord Frederick cried.
Listen!
Wah! Wah!
There was no mistaking the mewling newborn cry.
Hooray! Hooray!
The incorrigibles shouted, for they knew what the sound meant.
No, I have failed.
Edward Ashton writhed and struggled as the rope held him fast.
We will all perish.
No one's gonna perish, you big cry baby.
It was Madame Ionesco, emerging from Lady Constance's bedchamber.
Where's the new daddy?
Miss Mortimer gave Lord Frederick a nudge.
I believe the soothsayer means you, Frederick.
I suppose you're right. Here I am, soothsayer. What news? Do we have a baby, then?
He tugged at his jacket and smoothed his hair as if he were about to meet the Tsar himself.
Not exactly.
Madame Ionesco smiled her semi-toothless smile.
You better come see.
Old Timothy stayed in the parlour to keep watch over Edward Ashton. Reverent and wide-eyed with curiosity, the rest tiptoed into Lady Constance's bedchamber. Penelope looked around. Where is, she almost said Simon, by mistake. Where is Mrs. Penworthy? Madame Ionesco chuckled.
Oh, that one fainted half an hour ago. The speaking girl went to get smelling salts, not to worry.
A quick peek round the far side of the bed revealed Simon out cold on the floor. He snored manfully and seemed quite comfortable. And there, sitting up in bed in a rose-pink bed jacket, was Lady Constance. Her eyes were bright and her face was flushed with pretty pink circles on each cheek. Her butter-coloured hair had been combed into a simple ponytail. She looked rested and radiant and very, very pleased with herself.
"Poor Mrs. Penworthy," she said with a merry laugh. "You would have thought she had never seen a baby being born before. I shall tease her about it for months. I was quite brave, though, wasn't I, Madame Ionesco?"
Madame squeezed her hand.
"You were terrific."
"Constance, you devil!"
Lord Frederick had reached the wicker cradle, and he grinned from ear to ear.
"Well, this is a surprise. That's not a bouncing baby Ashton at all."
He puffed out his chest.
"That's two babies. Heedy-ho, two. A ready-made family."
"I had no idea," Lady Constance said modestly. "But I was rather large."
The babies were alike as two peas in a pod, and nestled against each other just as they had in the womb, snug in the blankets that had been knitted just for them.
"One's a boy and one's a girl," Madame Ionesco said. "But don't ask me which is which."
"It's their birthday," Beowulf pointed out.
At once the incorrigibles began to sing.
"For these are jolly good babies, for these are jolly good babies, for these are jolly good babies, and so say all of us."
The newborns slept through the singing, as well as the hip, hip hoorays that followed, but the noise did manage to rouse Simon.
"Good morning," he exclaimed, sitting up. "What am I doing on the floor?"
Then his head cleared.
"Wait a minute, the baby."
Then his head cleared a bit more, and he switched to his Mrs. Penworthy voice.
"I meant to say, the baby. Did I miss it?"
"No, you missed two babies,"
Cassiopeia crowed with glee. There was a crash of broken crockery in the parlour, as if a tea tray had been upended.
"Clumsy old Tim, sounds like we'll be needing a mop,"
Mrs. Clark said, not at all cross, but the door was flung open and Edward Ashton burst into the bedchamber, brandishing a knife.
"Hey," Peter Lumley exclaimed, "those were my best balloon tying knots. How did you get loose?"
"They were superb knots, sir," Ashton replied. "Impossible to untie, which is why it was so kind of you to leave a knife within reach."
He raised his right arm. In his hand was the bread knife that Peter Lumley had used to make sandwiches. The blade was still streaked yellow with mustard, or perhaps it was the gold threads of the bell pull cord, or both.
"Where is old Timothy?" Penelope cried.
"Out cold,"
Ashton nodded at the housekeeper.
"Mrs. Clark, my apologies for breaking a good teapot on the coachman's exceptionally hard head."
"Never mind the teapot, you brute. Poor Tim, at least you didn't commit..."
But then Mrs. Clark caught herself.
"Rhymes with birder,"
she finished. Edward Ashton's face twisted.
"I have no wish to harm that old man. Despite what you think of me, I am no monster."
"You're no hero either," Simon snapped, "barging in with a knife and scaring the daylights out of us all. You ought to be ashamed."
"I do not pretend to be a hero, but I will save my family. It is regrettable I can only save half."
He turned to Mater and Peter Lumley, who did not flinch even with the tip of the bread knife wobbling in their direction.
"You say you have four children. Are you quite sure?"
"Of course," Mater Lumley said. Her husband nodded.
"Five are needed to undo the curse." His voice grew sharp. "How many are missing, wolf children?"
"One,"
Cassiopeia squeaked, for although she was frightened, she could never resist a math problem.
"One is missing."
"Not anymore."
There was a terrible look on Edward Ashton's face.
"For now there is a fifth."
"And a sixth, too."
Lady Constance must have still been under the influence of the special bread Madame Ionesco had provided, for these terrible goings-on seemed not to trouble her at all.
"Not that I'm boasting, mind you. That would be ill-mannered."
Ashton's face registered surprise. for he had not yet looked inside the cradle.
Do you mean there are twins? How unexpected. But it changes nothing. It is only fair. There must be some sacrifice on Pax's side as well, it seems. So be it. I must be strong. I must do.